duties, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
How's it going, Higher Side Chatters? I'm Greg Carlwood, and it's another lovely, sunny San Diego day. A wonderful day in the neighborhood. A wonderful day for a neighbor. Perfect for smoking weed and drinking beers, which is what I'm doing, because I show patterns of self-destructive behavior, and that's just my style. In fact, I don't usually tell personal stories much on THC, but earlier in the week I was having a particularly bad day, and I said to my lovely lady Teresa that all I needed now was a run with the cops to top off my string of shit luck, and she would tell you that I manifested that reality with those words, but I would tell you that's an interesting idea, but cops are pretty reliable for fucking up my life, and what made this stop particularly interesting, and maybe the universe does have a message for me with this one, but on my drive home from work, I see a car pulled over on the shoulder up ahead. I instantly slow down to the speed limit. I get closer. I see that it is, in fact, a cop. His car door is open. He's walking around the car. No big deal. As I pass him, he's just about to sit in the driver's seat, and we fucking lock eyes, and I instantly had the feeling of, oh shit, this guy's definitely gunning for me. I'm kind of fucked. And sure enough, he pulls me over, and I had no idea what he could possibly have on me. I was completely shocked. Motherfucker walks up to my window, says he clocked me at 81. I say, that's not possible. I wasn't speeding, and I don't think you could have clocked me from outside the car. Well, he doesn't like my lip, so he tells me to sit on my hands on the side of the road while he searches my car, but he didn't find anything. This is a fairly typical stop, but it just pissed me off because he did not clock me for speeding. But he wanted to stop me because I looked at him, and he just threw out a reasonable number and wrote me a fucking ticket. Well, what the fuck? This is not a place I want to live anymore, people. But anyway, today on the show we got Nick Redfern, and it's a little rapid fire because I was supposed to be joined by Adam Gorightly and Ron Patton from Paranoia Magazine to talk about ParanoiaCon, but neither one could make it at the last minute, so my planning was a little light because I expected two other people to be chiming in. But either way, there's a bunch of great stories in Nick's new book, and we're going to fire them off at you right after I let you know about my main man, Plaid Klaus, who's making some awesome comics at mindcomics.com, M-I-N-D, comics.com. They focus on stories that evolve from conspiracy theories, science fiction, and travels into the multiverse through psychedelic exploration. You can check out the latest title, Off Grid, the story of the civil war between a technocratic enslaving government and a resistance group of ex-military and anonymous hackers fighting for their survival off grid. I believe they're still offering the first issue free, and they're really cheap otherwise, so check them out. They have a very awesome style. Plaid Klaus is actually working on a couple of conspiracies designs that I'm really pumped about. I don't know when I'll actually be able to print them. So far, the first one looks great, and I'm pumped about it. It's a reptilian shirt. Yo, there I said it, okay? So, either way, go explore the outer reaches of your mind at mindcomics.com. Plaid K also gave me a coupon code this week to give to you. So please, if you're going over there and you're checking out stuff off-grid, issue number one is totally free. Then use the code THC to get 20% off anything else you like. And the comics are so damn good, and they're only like $2. Support THC by supporting the people who support it. Finally, I'm going to ask you to support THC by picking up one of my badass shirts at conspiracies.net. That's my other little project that helps pay the rent. So here's that noise, and Nick Redfern will be on the other side. I love you.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
All right, welcome back, people. You know, the world is filled with weirdness, and some of my favorite stories are the tales of anomalous cryptids running around out there, giant sea monsters, Bigfoot, the Mothman, the list goes on and on. And our guest today, Nick Redfern, is no stranger to UFO, conspiracy, and cryptozoology research. He's been peeking behind the curtain for almost 20 years now. He's written many great books, including The NASA Conspiracies, The Real Men in Black, and Body Snatchers in the Desert. And his new book, Monster Files, A Look Inside Government Secrets and Classified Documents on Bizarre Creatures and Extraordinary Animals, is no different. Where the weirdness flows is where the red fern goes. And completing the circuit and his third appearance in the show, creating a trifecta of awesomeness and the holy trinity that the good book describes, here he is, Nick Redfern. How are you?
Hey, Greg. Doing good, thanks. How's it going?
It's going well, man. Couldn't be better, you know? Cool. The first time we talked, it was sort of an overview of a lot of your work, but I think the biggest focus was The Pyramid and the Pentagon on episode 25, which is a great book about government files pertaining to seeking out of ancient relics, Noah's Ark, similar things like that. And it was awesome because it showed that the government has taken something seriously that would probably surprise a lot of people, which is sort of the same case on a different subject in Monster Files, right?
Yeah, well, Monster Files is probably on my most sort of favorite subject and area of investigation. That's cryptozoology, which is the study of unknown animals like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, the Chupacabra, Abominable Snowman, sea serpents, and so on. And I've written about 7 or 8 books over the years on various aspects of cryptozoology. Most of the books sort of written in sort of diary road trip style, just following me on the expeditions. But Monster Files is sort of significantly different because it deals with an aspect of cryptozoology that not only does it not get really much coverage, but most people probably aren't even aware it exists. And that is the way in which and how and for how long government agencies all around the world have secretly taken an interest in strange creatures and put together files on them, investigated them, and in some cases, in weird fashion, even created them as well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned creating them, because the one I really liked, mainly because it might have cracked the case on it, was the Flatwoods Monster, you know, which I always thought was one of the most unique creatures out there that people had described seeing. But I mean, you want to start off with that story and the connection you made to maybe a practical answer?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Flatwoods Monster is a creature that goes back to September 1952 and the little town of Flatwoods in West Virginia. And I say little town because even today the population is still only in the 400s. And back in 52, when this occurred, it was just in the 300s, you know, so it hasn't really grown much at all. It's sort of a very rural, sort of wooded, you know, farm type area. And throughout the summer and the late summer of 1952, there was a huge wave of UFO activity all across the United States. And one of the strangest events occurred in Flatwoods in September, and a number of the people in the town reported after the sun was going down, you know, darkness was setting in, they saw this strange object sort of shoot across the sky, and it seemed to land, or come down at least, in a large area which was sort of dominated by sort of mountainous hill and forest land. And a number of the townsfolk went out there to try and figure out what it was. And they came across this sort of strange, eerie fog and heard strange noises coming out of the woods and unusual illumination in the background. So clearly something strange was going on. But that was sort of made even more strange and, I guess, frightening for the people, because this huge thing came clambering or lumbering out of the woods. And it was described as being about 12 feet tall. But unlike, you know, like a hairy Bigfoot creature or something like that, it was described as being like a mechanical monster in some fashion, which kind of sounds bizarre, but it sort of befits that period of the 1950s, you know, when you had all those weird sci-fi movies coming out with robots and things. But it was described as being about, as I said, about 12 feet tall, humanoid, but it had all these weird flashes and sparks and bangs coming off it that, you know, gave it a monstrous angle, but a robotic angle as well. Not surprisingly, everybody sort of fled for their lives down the hill, and it was never seen again. It was one of these cases, you know, where you had a, like, almost like a unique creature that didn't surface before and never surfaced afterwards even. And one of the things I was doing research on in the book was this whole angle, but actually for other chapters in the book, on how government agencies had used psychological warfare programs to create myths of monsters to frighten the enemy. And in doing this, I got hold of a RAND document, which had been prepared for the US Air Force in 1950. It was a document that talked about how RAND had prepared all this data for the US Air Force on how psychological warfare could be used from the perspective of using mythology and folklore to defeat enemies rather than, you know, just guns and missiles or whatever.
Yeah.
And in this particular file, there's a reference to how during the Second World War, the British Army created this thing that sounds eerily like the Flatwoods Monster. It was described as being exactly the same height, 12 feet tall, and it was like a robotic thing that had all these wires and lights all over it, which could be sort of lit up and, you know, sparks and arcs coming off it to give it sort of this effect of something sort of monstrous, if you like. And what the British Army did, they sort of unleashed it in and around the fringes of little towns in Italy. You know, during the Second World War, the Italians were helping the Germans. And so the idea was they sort of briefly released this thing or sort of towed it or, you know, sort of remotely controlled it. And the plan was then to sort of tell the villagers, well, this is like a visit from, you know, some sort of satanic creature, basically, you know, cursing you for helping the Germans. And, you know, in a lot of these isolated little Italian villages, it worked. Now, of course, during the 1950s, 1952, there were no sort of Italian or German spies running around Flatwoods. So, you know, you have to wonder what's the motivation. If, you know, this was an outgrowth of the British psychological warfare thing of the 40s. And you have to look at these similarities. As I said, the height of the creature was the same. They both gave off these weird sparks and arcs and electric static and things like this. They were both seen in little isolated towns. And the British Army program was a psychological warfare-based one. And the reference to it turns up in a U.S. Air Force psychological warfare document. And the U.S. Air Force was heavily interested in what people were saying about the Flatwoods case. So, you know, you have all these tangents and ties. And my speculation actually allows for like a real genuine UFO phenomenon and possibly for manipulation using a created thing at Flatwoods. And I'll explain what I mean by that. It's pretty clear when you read the files that have surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act on what was going on in 52, that elements of the military and the intelligence community realized there was a real UFO phenomenon that they didn't understand. Some of these documents talk about, well, how might the general public react in the event of a real UFO invasion, or if they showed themselves sort of en masse across the planet, how would people react? Well, they had no way of knowing because the UFO phenomenon, they couldn't predict how it would act. You know, it was almost like ghostly, you know, here one thing on the next. So I kind of wonder if they may have sort of set up an event in Flatwoods to try and then secretly watch and monitor the response to see how people reacted, in because that would give them an ability to gauge how the reaction might occur in a real life situation with the phenomenon. So, you know, in other words, if you can't predict the phenomenon is going to appear and you can't predict how people react, why not stage an event? Because that would give you like a similar outcome, so to speak. And the very fact that everybody at Flatwoods sort of fled for their lives, screaming for their lives, may well have given the military an idea of, well, now we know what to expect in the real world when it really happens. So I actually think, you know, there is a real phenomenon, but I think at times things like this have been done to try and determine, again, you know, how myths can be used and what the reaction and the result is on the people who are exposed to it.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that was really interesting because I'm sure you've heard about the stories of Project Bluebeam, where the government has supposedly entertained the idea of creating a holographic alien invasion or like a second coming of Christ over Cuba or something like that. But, I mean, that story is kind of right in the same wheelhouse.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's you know, bear in mind we're sort of talking about 60 years ago. I mean, today the technology would be much greater. But what I do find interesting is that both in the Second World War thing and this one from Flatwoods, you know, it was described like a relatively unsophisticated sort of clambering, sparking thing, almost, you know, like the robot out Forbidden Planet or something like that, you know. So you can imagine maybe back then they could have put something like that together, but, you know, something far more expansive today, like sophisticated holograms, you know, just weren't around then. So.
Yeah, I mean, if you saw that Tupac thing, they've got some serious technology. But, you know, there's a couple tales like that in Monster Files where government agencies either made or hyped up rumors of strange creatures or vampire-like beasts. But are there any stories in the book that you find particularly interesting that lead in the direction of involving a real unknown creature?
Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the big areas of interest of mine is Bigfoot. But whereas most cryptozoologists just take the view that, you know, Bigfoot is the North American equivalent of like an African gorilla.
Right.
I don't. You know, I think there's more to Bigfoot. I think Bigfoot is, it may well be a flesh and blood creature, but it's far stranger than just an unknown ape roaming the US. There are a lot of cases, for example, where Bigfoot has been seen at the same time frame and location as UFO activity. People have reported sort of strange visions after seeing Bigfoot or having visits from Men in Black type characters and things like that. Now, certainly these cases aren't anywhere near the majority of reports, you know, but they are sort of 5, 6, 7, 8% of the total, which is still a significant amount. And so what I find interesting is that when we're not, although we're not seeing government or military interest in every Bigfoot report under the sun, what we are seeing is that in many of these cases of high strangeness, government people do pop up and take an interest. For example, in the book, I talk about Stan Gordon, a researcher who back in the early to mid-70s investigated a wave of Bigfoot-type activity in Pennsylvania, where Stan still lives to this day. And in these particular cases, they were highly and repeatedly associated with UFO activity. And Stan and a number of witnesses he was aware of all got visited by government people, but not in like a sinister MIB sense, but basically quietly saying, hey, you know, we're interested in these reports. Can you keep us informed? You know, which is in itself was kind of weird. But yeah. I talk about a few cases like that in the book where there's deep military interest and there's been a subsequent cover-up put into place. And if Bigfoot, you know, if these creatures were just North American apes that science hadn't found, why place it under a cover-up? You know, it would be a zoological revelation. It wouldn't be something affecting national security unless there is this other aspect to it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes wonder the same thing. Like, if some of these weirder creatures, like Mothman or Shadow People, they might be some type of multi-dimensional manifestation, maybe from conjurers like Aleister Crowley or that Michael Aquino guy, because they don't always seem like flesh and blood creatures. I mean, even Bigfoot, there's some stories that people can't shoot it.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually one of my big areas of interest. And I do believe that either these creatures sort of zip in and out of our reality, you know, sort of multi-dimensions, that kind of thing, or when I say or, it could be either or both. They could be some sort of like a tulpa type thing. A tulpa is like a thought form where the human mind can sort of create something and then externalize it, and it has some sort of like its own independent quasi-reality. And, it, you know, they supposedly feed on high states of human emotion to sustain them. And so, you know, the whole point is these things would have to be seen to then allow them to sort of bleed dry the emotion from the witness. And, you know, this is actually one of the theories that's been applied. It's a bit of off topic, but to the Men in Black mystery. You know, the Men in Black often come across, not like government agents in the films, you know, they're these creepy, weird, little, ghoulish, vampire-type characters, you know. And witnesses often talk about feeling hypnotized and drained of energy, almost like a diabetic, you know, if they missed a meal and they started to crash or something. They feel like that. And they've actually said they felt drained. So a lot of people are sort of coming around to the idea now, maybe the MIB, you know, create this feeling of fear in the witness, not because they're actually threatening them, but it's like a fake threat. But the idea is to create fear, which they then feed on. And then maybe creatures like Bigfoot, you know, do exactly the same. They're almost like emotional vampires, if you like.
Yeah. That is a super interesting topic. It's just so hard to know. You know, one of the first weird things in the world that I was drawn to as a young kid, I was glad to see in your book, is Tales of the Loch Ness Monster. You know, it seems much juicier to me than Bigfoot because I used to love dinosaurs. I always wanted to believe that it was real. And but it seems to have faded out quite a lot in recent years. And yes, there's still no smoking gun, but you have discovered some files that show that many government agencies have looked into Nessie and have failed to find an explanation for some of the footage they've studied, which has kind of restored my hope.
Good. Well, yeah. I mean, Loch Ness, you know, it's a large body of water. It's like 22 miles long, about a mile wide, and at its deepest point, officially around about 800 feet, but there are stories about sort of cavernous areas and tunnels below that might take it conceivably below like 1,000 feet deep. So it's a very large body of water. Now, of course, if the creatures of Loch Ness are fish or, you know, some sort of creature that doesn't need to surface for air, then we probably wouldn't see them very often, you know, just by chance when they decided to surface for who knows what reason. But primarily, you know, if they're living exclusively under the water, there probably wouldn't be that many sightings. And because Loch Ness is far more busier than it was decades ago with, you know, boats and traffic going from one side of the lake, the loch to the other, then it might sort of have led these creatures to sort of stay in the deeper depths almost exclusively now. But regardless of, you know, the sort of the changes in trends of sightings and whatever, I did get a hold of a number of files on the Loch Ness Monster that are being put together by various British government agencies. One of them was a group in the 1960s called JARIC, which stands for the Joint Air Reconnaissance Intelligence Center. And these are the people, kind of like the British equivalents, like in the US, where, you know, if there's rumors about a new missile base being built in China, you know, they sent like a high-flying spy plane over years ago or tonight or today, like a spy satellite, and photograph it. And then the photographs are sent back to, you know, military experts who can analyze photographs and determine, you know, does this show a new aircraft hangar, or those missiles, you know, et cetera, that kind of thing. And that's what JARIC was, jobs was, to sort of look at spy photographs of overseas potentially hostile military installations and determine what they showed. But in the mid-1960s, JARIC set up like an in-house little project to study film footage and photographs of nothing less than the Loch Ness Monster. And what was interesting, bearing in mind, you know, the caliber of the people working for the group, in a good percentage of all the imagery they looked at, they ruled out things like logs falling into the loch or rotting trees sort of surfacing when the, you know, the gas levels change and just breaking the surface. They ruled out things like wave formations or shadows or rowing boats. And in many cases said that what they were looking at appeared to be independent, intelligent entities, creatures. And in some cases, they could see shadows that seemed to suggest that whatever was on the surface was actually only a small portion. And they could make out vague evidence of what looked like a larger part of the creature below the water. So that in itself, you know, is significant for several reasons. One, you know, it demonstrates that the footage and photographs can be vindicated. And number two, the people doing the analysis were the best people you could ask for within the UK. You know, they were military experts just solely focused on that field. Now, the next files that I got hold of, pretty much all dated from the 1980s and during the when Margaret Thatcher was the Prime Minister. And the government had this plan, almost like a harebrained plan, to train dolphins to swim in Loch Ness and to try and find the Loch Ness Monsters. And the idea was to have the dolphins strapped with cameras and sonar equipment, which could be sort of triggered remotely, you know, in the event that they came across one of these creatures. But not much thought seems to have been given to the idea of how they would actually teach the dolphins to chase the monsters when, you know, nobody had actually got an example of the monster to show them, you know.
Right.
So that was a problem. The other one that not much thought was given to was, well, what happens if there is a confrontation between the monsters and the dolphins? You know, is it going to end in a bloodbath? And then the other thing was, well, when it's all over, how do we encourage the dolphins to come back to shore and, you know, put them in a tank and get them out of the lock again? So it was all of these different aspects that eventually led the government to drop the plan. But what's interesting is that, you know, we've been secret for a few years. This idea was sort of nurtured and built upon, and a lot of thought went into it. But as I said, sometimes, you know, these projects go ahead. Other times, they're just sort of relegated to, you know, some dusty shelf because they were just too weird to work, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if there were some type of prehistoric creature or something there, if it's even still there, if they'd even be able to survive still, or, you know, maybe. Well, there's never been a corpse found, I don't either, so.
Well, I mean, if these creatures are some sort of fish, I mean, you know, the plesiosaur is an interesting angle. You know, plesiosaurs were marine reptiles that existed during the dinosaur era. But, you know, they were largely, or exclusively, as far as we know, saltwater creatures because they lived in the oceans, whereas Loch Ness is freshwater.
Right.
However, there are some animals, you know, that can adapt. For example, you have saltwater crocodiles and you have freshwater crocodiles. But it's, you know, it may well be the case that if these things are ancient, presumed extinct animals, you know, they might actually really become extinct before we prove what they are. And we'll never know. But, you know, I'm not sort of too worried about the fact that we haven't found a corpse, because if these things exclusively or almost exclusively live in the water, although there are one or two land reports, then they're going to die in the water. And, you know, nature's going to take care of them. The smaller fish are going to eat them, you know, and so on.
True.
That's how nature works. So that doesn't surprise me as such, you know, that they would just sink to the bottom and rot or get eaten. But, I mean, there are a lot of other interesting theories as well. Things like giant eels, you know, sort of a 30 to 40-foot giant eel, which,
yeah,
I guess by definition would still be a monster, you know.
True.
Or the other theory that's been given is something like a giant salamander. Salamanders, you know, can grow up to like 6 or 7 feet, but, you know, a 30-footer would still be sort of a monstrous creature. So, you know, I'm not sort of tied to the idea that it's nothing or it's a plesiosaur. I think there are other scenarios. And I do really believe that there have been and maybe still are strange creatures in the Loch. But a lot of people don't realize that Loch Ness is actually connected to the Atlantic Ocean by the Caledonian Canal. You go through like a series of locks and gates, you know, to like a regular canal. So what this means is today you have an incredible amount of traffic on Loch Ness, and not just little rowing boats, but huge boats that are going to cross the Atlantic. So, you know, if these creatures are there and they're not stupid, they're going to realize that the days and centuries and decades ago when Loch Ness was relatively quiet have long gone. So they may just simply stay down in the deeper depths. You know, it may not be that they're extinct. They just don't surface much because Loch Ness is like, you know, the local highway or whatever now, you know.
Man, it is a fascinating case. But what's also very intriguing that I found in your book is several accounts of government files you've uncovered that detail some pretty conventional animals involved in some pretty unconventional experiments and programs. You want to tell us about a couple of those?
Yeah, well, one of the strangest ones I talk about in the book is a CIA program that became known as Acoustic Kitty. And this is a project from the 1960s, and it sounds almost like, it's almost like an animal equivalent of the $6 Million Man or something,
yeah,
or Terminator or RoboCop. The idea was to try and take regular cats, like house cats, pet cats, and insert them and wire them up with sort of like transmitting and equipment and radio antenna and things like that. And the idea was, it sounds totally far-fetched until you realize, you know, that the files now are starting to surface through the Freedom of Information Act. Some of them are actually quite heavily redacted, but, you know, we have got a few which confirm the existence of the project. And the idea was to have these cats sort of wired up with all this electronic gear and gizmos, etc., and try and train them to walk around the grounds of the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. And, you know, if a couple of guys walking past, say, named Boris and Ivan, you know, in the grounds, we're talking about some classified program, and the cat's wired up with all this sort of radio antenna and microphones, and he picked up the conversation. The conversation that could then be broadcast to CIA headquarters and transcribed, you know. So it would almost be like, instead of putting bugging devices in the offices or the rooms of the embassy, you know, no one would think that a little cat wandering around was a walking, meowing bugging device, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the idea. And incredibly, the very first cat that was chosen for the operation actually survived having all this sort of wires and mechanical gear inserted into its body. The problem was, of course, that, you know, with hindsight, I mean, cats aren't the easiest animals to train. You know, if you're going to want to train an animal, a dog's far better. Cats basically look at you and give you the finger, you know what I mean? And so that made it problematic. But on the very first occasion when they had the cat ready to go, so to speak, a team of CIA agents, you know, regular-looking van just pulled up as close to the Soviet embassy as they could, opened the back doors and sort of urged the cat to sort of cross the road towards the embassy and hope for the best. But he only got like a few feet and it was splattered by a taxi that was speeding along the road. And so that was the end of Acoustic Kitty, and it was actually the end of the program. And the files that have surfaced through Freedom of Information show that the reason was that it was just perceived as having too many factors that couldn't be, you know, necessarily, you know, chosen for and dictated. You know, there were too many random events that could go wrong, and so the thing was shut down. But again, it sort of demonstrates some of the really weird aspects of, you know, how regular animals are used in sort of an irregular practice, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, that is pretty morbid. Another one that was pretty interesting, you know, we had, I don't know if you're familiar with Rupert Sheldrake, but we had him on the show recently. He's done a lot of research into animal ESP with dogs. Mm. You know, dogs that know when their owners are coming home, they seem to just know as soon as the owner stands up at their desk at work, and it's like a ESP kind of thing. And you also have kind of a story about dog ESP in the book, too.
Yeah, this goes back to the early 1950s, and again, this is from files which have surfaced from the U.S. Army through the Freedom of Information Act. And they talk about a little project that was set up in 1952 to see if dogs possessed ESP. And the plan was that if they did possess ESP, could it be used to locate landmines on battlefields? Now, the papers, again, are fairly redacted in some places, but they show that two German Shepherd dogs were chosen for this particular project. Their names were Tessie and Binnie. And we don't know, because we don't have all the files, but we don't know how or why, or under what circumstances, I should say, that their psychic powers were deemed to be real, but apparently they were. And so what happened was that this program went ahead on various stretches of beach, sort of down by Highway 1 in California, you know, sort of running from Los Angeles way up to San Francisco. And various pieces of beach were chosen. And dummy mines were sort of, they weren't live mines. Dummy mines were sort of laid out on the beach, or in some cases, actually like 6 or 7 feet down. And in a couple of cases, they buried them a few feet down, but like 15 feet out to sea. And then the dogs would be sort of unloaded from the van or whatever, and then sent out to try and find, you know, the mines. And interestingly enough, in something like 70 or 80% of the trials, they actually succeeded. But for some weird reason, even when some of the cases where the mines were easily locatable, they didn't find them. And so the ultimate conclusion of the military was that there clearly seemed to be some unknown power or skill that the dogs possessed that allowed them to find the mines. But it didn't work every time. You know, there were times when it was hit and miss and it couldn't be predicted. And that's kind of like the whole thing with the government and the remote viewing programs of the 70s and onwards, you know, where they had a lot of good remote viewers who, and it was clear they had some skills. But then there were other times, you know, when it just shut down. It was almost like the equivalent of writer's block or something like that, you know. And I think that's the reason with this psychic dog program, why it was pretty much shut down, was not so much because they didn't have successes, they did, but because they couldn't predict the successes, and when it failed, it just totally failed. And so they sort of preferred to go back to sort of regular human resources, I suppose, and more conventional ways of looking for the minds.
Yeah, and when it fails in the field, I mean, that's going to be a pretty nasty
exactly.
mess for the PR team.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, you know, messing with dolphins and cats and dogs, they're, you know, they... It's almost like the governments just use these animals as tools more than thinking them of them as live creatures. But, you know, there's another crazy thing about the Soviet Union, I believe it was, who attempted to crossbreed apes with people. I mean, that was a fascinating chapter, a pretty creepy chapter.
Yeah, this goes back way back to the 1920s, and a Russian scientist named Ilya Ivanov, and he was a very brilliant Russian scientist, but he was also like a typical sort of Dr. Frankenstein mad professor type. He had an obsession, and it is fair to call it an obsession, not just an interest. We're trying to crossbreed humans with apes, and particularly gorillas and chimpanzees. Now, you know, back in the 1920s, there was nothing like gene splicing, you know, and DNA was in its infancy, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, the Soviet government's Academy of Sciences actually funded Ivanov to a highly significant amount, to where he was able to travel, had the funding to travel to West Africa, and had an entire team that helped him round up a number of female gorillas and chimpanzees. And laboratories were built all across West Africa and some in Russia as well, where these experiments went ahead. Now, as I said, you know, it was nothing like gene splicing. So basically...
Yeah, the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, the old-fashioned way, exactly. Now, of course, nobody wanted to volunteer to impregnate the gorillas, so they had to essentially, you know, just take human sperm and inject it into anaesthetized gorillas and chimpanzees. Now, granted, you know, we're actually like 98% compatible DNA-wise with chimpanzees, but it's that small percentage that isn't compatible that makes us look so different from chimpanzees and act so different. And nature, you know, has a way of ensuring that sort of freaks of nature and, you know, interspecies offspring don't occur.
Right.
And as far as we know, at least, or the official story, is that all these experiments that Ivanov undertook ended in failure. But there are a few rumors suggesting that maybe against all the odds, you know, a few freakish creatures were born to these, you know, to the female chimpanzees and gorillas, and that the stories about some of them living just briefly, others, you know, suggesting they lived actually a long time and looked sort of like sort of a freakish cross between humans and apes, you know. And one of the ironic theories is that some of these offspring that were sort of supposedly mentally retarded and, you know, it would have brought shame on the whole project, rather than being killed, you know, because they were part human, they were banished to the wilds of, like, Siberia. And then when people saw them, it gave rise to the idea that, oh, Russia's got its own Bigfoot, you know, not realizing it was maybe the outgrowth of some of these secret projects. So I don't think we've probably heard the end of the story. I think there's probably more to uncover. And, you know, maybe, as I said, against all the odds, one or two experiments really did work. You know, we just don't really know, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's wild. There's a photo in the book that is of a suggested hybrid that is pretty interesting, too.
Yeah, that's a woman named Julia Pastrana. And back in the 19th century, like a lot of people who had, unfortunately, had like sort of physical afflictions, you know, she earned her living in the so-called old circus freak shows, that kind of thing. Now, what we know for sure is that she had a condition called hypertrichosis, and that's a real condition. It's where the body and the face and pretty much everywhere just grows massive amounts of excess hair, you know, and it just covers the entire body and face all over. And it's unofficially known as werewolf syndrome, mm-hmm. Which gives you sort of an idea of how a person looks. But if the person sort of regularly shaves or has the hair, you know, sort of medically removed, they look just like a normal, regular person. You know, you would never know until the stubble starts to come through again. But Julia Pastrana, she looks very strange because as well as being covered in hair, She has almost, I won't say deformed jaws, but she has like elongated and very muscular looking powerful jaws, not unlike a gorilla or a chimpanzee. And so she looks very strange. And the fact that she is covered in hair suggests that maybe her hypertrichosis wasn't due to the regular condition, because the regular condition doesn't cause facial or appearance abnormalities. And she, you know, is one of the ones who there are still questions raised about, you know, was she completely human or, again, you know, was she one of these, some sort of offspring that's, you know, again, against every odd, but managed to survive, you know.
Yeah, it definitely is a picture worth looking at for anyone who's interested. You know, another subject you've looked in before, I think, it also crops up in this book under the label of ABCs, you know, the alien big cats. But what was interesting about their appearance in Monster Files is there seems to be a connection between Princess Diana and these cats, apparently, right?
Well, by default, she's been linked to a conspiracy concerning the big cats. Now, all across Britain for decades have been reports of big cats on the loose, kind of like the equivalent of like a fully grown black leopard or, you know, sort of mountain lion that you would see in the Pacific Northwest forest, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there shouldn't be anything like that running around the UK at all, you know, other than pet cats. The only other cat in Britain is called the Scottish Wildcat, which, as its name suggests, it lives in the wild and it lives in Scotland. But even the wildcat, it's barely any bigger than a normal house cat, and it looks just like a house cat, but it's actually quite savage, and, you know, they will give you a nasty scratch or bite if you get too close to them in the wild. But, you know, you're not going to mistake a Scottish wildcat for a mountain lion, you know, there's no comparison. And yet people see these things every day. So the big question is, where are they from? Well, part of the answer probably lies in the fact that back in 1976, the government passed a law, the Dangerous Wild Animals Act, which meant that anybody who wanted to own a big cat or a large cat had to have a license and a fully secure enclosure to keep it in. Before that, as incredible as it sounds, anyone in the UK could own a big cat and just keep it in their backyard. And it's amazing nobody got killed. And, and we know people did, but because some of them couldn't afford to, you know, pay for the new license and build new enclosures, a few people have come forward to say, well, you know, we let our cats go into the woods in the middle of the night, and there were males and females, and you know, they may have mated. And then, you know, today we've seen third or fourth generation cats after the 1976 releases. That explains part of the story. But the problem is the reports going back decades before that, and actually into the 17th and 18th centuries. So, you know, maybe sailors from overseas brought back cats, you know, and they're actually been breeding for centuries in the wild, you know, and in secret. I think so, you know, we've got a couple of angles. But people nevertheless still see these cats today. You know, the hundreds of reports come in every year. So there's clearly something going on. Now, in the late 1980s, a friend of mine named John Downs, who, like me, writes books and investigates strange creatures, John got a telephone call from a former British Army soldier, and he was part of like an elite unit that was shadowing Princess Diana, because the British government and military intelligence had picked up on rumors, which they took very seriously, that some organization or possibly several were planning to either kidnap or assassinate Princess Diana. And they didn't want to alarm the princess, and they didn't want the story getting out to the media, because their plan was, if they kept it under wraps, it would help them to track down who these people were, because if it was spilled all over the newspapers, then the people would just go to hiding and they'd never find them, and, you know, then they could plan another attack later on. So they wanted to keep it all under wraps. And so what they did, this small unit of like five or six soldiers, you know, so highly trained, you know, used to maneuvers at night time, very skilled with guns and pistols, rifles, whatever, they would shadow and watch Diana wherever she went. Now, this was, John got the call in 1989, and the group, its activities began around about 1985 onwards. And at some point between those years, the group actually shadowed Diana when she travelled down to the old English county of Devonshire. For people who are wondering, Devonshire is where Sir Arthur Conan Doyle set the Sherlock Holmes novel, The Hound of the Baskervilles. So it's like this foggy old moorland with old castles and stone circles and, you know, it looks exactly the same today. It looks like you step back in time, you know, and you expect to see this blazing-eyed hound come, you know, racing across the moors. But this was the time when Diana's marriage to Prince Charles, you know, was sort of on the rocks, and she was seeing other people, boyfriends, etc. at the time. And one of these actually lived in a little village on Dartmoor, excuse me, in Devonshire. And so this team shadowed Diana and essentially sort of made like a stakeout in the village late at night, and sort of, you know, stayed in the shadows behind bushes, etc., just keeping an eye on the property where Diana was visiting. And to the amazement of the troops, when they were looking through night scopes, you know, just keeping envisioned on the house, they saw this huge black cat sort of go prowling past the side of the property and literally right past the front door, you know, which was almost like the worst national security issue you could think of. You know, they were trained to deal with, you know, terrorists or whatever, and here's this savage black cat. And they didn't know what to do. You know, it was like if they shoot it, well, it's going to wake the entire village up, and before you know it, the tabloid press will be on the story, and it will all come tumbling out. If they didn't do anything, the very fact that the cat was right by the door, you know, what if it broke in and, you know, attacked the princess, you know, or killed her, even worse. So they didn't know what to do, and they actually chose to do nothing and just sort of held their breath and just kept their sights trained on the cat. But they figured that, you know, it was looking for small animals to eat or whatever, and eventually they watched it as it just sort of sauntered off and headed off towards the moors, and it was gone. Now, as John was told when this soldier related the facts years later, there really was a conspiracy put into place to hide the truth of these big cats by the military. You know, the military itself realized these things existed, but they elected to cover it up because, by default, if they revealed what they knew about the big cats and how they knew it, it would then reveal what they were doing down in Devonshire and why they happened to see it. So, in other words, it was like the cover-up of the big cats was forced on them by the fact that they had to cover up the fact that they were watching Diana. So it's almost like a roundabout conspiracy, but still a conspiracy nevertheless.
Yeah, I wonder how many stories out there are really, like, how many things we'd love to get information on are cover-ups just because they're associated with some other thing that we don't even really care about that's probably somewhat boring, but to the government, it's like a serious security issue.
Well, I actually think that probably happens a lot, you know, because we tend to focus on if the government's hiding, you know, like if the British military's hiding something on big cats, you know, we automatically think, oh, well, they're hiding it because they don't want the general public to panic. And that may well be part of it. But it may also be the fact that, something else is going on. And until somebody comes forward like John's informant, all you're seeing is one part of the picture. And that part of the picture you are seeing actually looks credible and understandable. But then when you see the other part, it's totally sort of throws a spanner in the works, so to speak, and you know, the whole thing is turned on its head, where you still have a conspiracy, but for a totally different reason to the one you were expecting.
Yeah, and another topic that was in the book that is really interesting is the Iceman. A lot of people are probably familiar with the stories of the Iceman. We actually had someone come on and talk about it not long ago, who basically just thought the whole thing was a fraud. But you know, you have uncovered some people's testimonies who've talked about it and said they could smell the creature. So I mean, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the Minnesota Iceman actually goes back to the mid-1960s, and just as an aside, the model that some people say was always a model is actually going to be unveiled this coming Saturday at the Museum of the Weird in Austin, Texas. It goes on public display there.
Nice.
After being sort of in a state of limbo for years. So if you're ever in Austin, Texas, you can go down to the Museum of the Weird and see it encased in ice. But the story is that back in the mid-1960s, a man named Frank Hansen, who lived in Minnesota, Hansen was one of these guys who put on, like, you know, controversial displays at, like, state fairs, you know, come and see the two-headed snake and the bearded lady, that kind of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And he acquired this body encased in a huge block of ice. And supposedly, it had come to Hansen from an anonymous millionaire friend of his, who in turn had supposedly got it from, well, we're not really sure where. One theory is that it was like a primitive, hair-covered, human-type creature shot in the woods of Minnesota, hence why it became known as the Minnesota Iceman. Another theory, which is sort of more intriguing, is it was actually shot and killed by troops in the Vietnam War, in the jungles of Vietnam, and then secretly shipped back to the U.S. By this millionaire who had it arranged in a body bag, you know, like a soldier's body bag, and then handed over to him. And then when Hansen made friends with him, you know, he agreed to allow Frank Hansen to put it on display for a while, before it was replaced supposedly with like a sophisticated dummy. Now, of course, as you pointed out, you know, some people do think the entire thing was a hoax and the only body that ever existed was the dummy. But yeah, there are reasons to think that wasn't the case. For example, in the mid-1960s, a number of well-respected cryptozoologists such as Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Hoovelmans traveled up to Minnesota to visit the display, actually before it went on display. And they said that looking through the ice, you know, it didn't look like a dummy. It looked highly sophisticated. It didn't look like, you know, hair stuck on or just like a gorilla suit, you know, that you would get from a novelty store or whatever. And as they got close to the ice and peered in it, they could sort of smell this putrid, rotting smell, you know, which is like a fairly sophisticated thing to do if you're going to hoax it, you know, to cover the ice in rotted meat or something like that. So that led them to actually believe, you know, it was a real creature. And they said that it was like shot through the eye and it looked like a real bullet hole. You know, it didn't look like you know, makeup or anything like that. And it went on display various places over the years and through the 70s. And then, you know, after time, it sort of went missing for a while and then just got, you know, stored away, etc. But at the height of the mania for it, if you like, in the late 1960s, none other than the FBI got involved, because you had this rumor that the Iceman wasn't some sort of unknown ape, but was a primitive type of human. And when rumors began to circulate that it had been shot, you know, bureaucracy got involved and said, well, even if it's a primitive human, it still might be human. And if it was shot, that means a murder took place. Right. And so the FBI got involved and actually sent one of their special agents out to Hansen's home and, you know, knocked on the door and said, you know, I'm Special Agent so-and-so. I'm here to see the Minnesota Iceman, which is kind of surreal, you know. Right. And Hansen, you know, not every day he gets a knock on the door, I suppose, from the FBI, and a bit perturbed and worried. So he let the agent in and freely let him look at it. And the conclusion was, well, you know, I don't think it's a man. And it's up to you as to whether you promote it as an Iceman or a monster or whatever. And, you know, the FBI agent went away satisfied with the only thing he was concerned about, that it wasn't a human. But Hansen was one of these who never missed an opportunity to promote the Iceman. So what he did, he quickly got a big board and some paint and painted a huge board that said the Minnesota Iceman investigated by the FBI, which he put on display every time the creature was on display. So, you know, it's a strange story, again, of sort of quasi-involvement on the part of the government for a very weird reason, but possibly like an understandable reason as well.
Yeah, it's just a shame that they had to involve a dummy. You know, it's just like, it just hurts the credibility of the case. It makes it kind of skeptical. I'm sick of being duped, you know? We get all these cases of, oh, we found a Bigfoot, and then we test the DNA, and it's a possum mixed with a raccoon, you know?
Well, that's why, you said, this is one of the reasons why I think Bigfoot's more paranormal, because every time somebody talks about a body, there's always an either or a but or an if. You know, there's always something that suggests it could be fake, you know, or a model or whatever. And yet we get lots of credible sightings, yet we never get a credible report of a body. And this leads me to believe, or this is why I believe, that Bigfoot is sort of less flesh and blood and more paranormal based, because the sheer number of reports we get, sighting reports, we should get at least one body, you know, where we can say definitively this is what it is, but we don't. You know, if we only got a handful of sighting reports and a handful of body reports, that's different. But we get thousands, you know, there are thousands of sighting reports, but no official body. So I think this is a pointer to the probability that you know, in many of these cases, we are dealing with a paranormal type creature that maybe isn't flesh and blood in the way we even understand it, and possibly can't even be killed in the way we understand it either.
Yeah, I mean, I have heard people give a lot of examples similar to this, but one I can remember is people say, you know, I've been to a lot of cities and I've seen a lot of pigeons, but have you ever seen a baby pigeon? You know, clearly they exist. Yeah, they have to exist.
Well, that is true on the one hand, but then again, you know, a baby pigeon's probably like 3 inches long, you know.
Right, a little easier to hide.
Than an 8-foot-tall lumbering ape, you know, running around just a couple of, you know, an hour's drive from Seattle or whatever, you know. So.
Right. If it was like a regular ape, you'd think there might be one case of it just wandering into a city, you know, a big city where like hundreds of people see it and it ends up dead.
Well, that's the thing. It's like chimpanzees and gorillas. We know they could exist because they've either got shot or they've made a mistake or they've died in the woods and been found. You know, Bigfoot eludes us 100% of the time. There are no other animals other than these cryptids that do that. You know, it's like saying most people never see a mountain lion, but people do, and we have bodies of them and we have them in zoos. But because they do elude us most of the time, but not all the time. But Bigfoot does do it all the time, you know.
I mean, well, since this book is really focused on government files of weird creatures, let me ask you if there's any cryptid legends out there that you have a personal interest but couldn't really find any files on to fit into this particular book.
Well, yeah, I mean, I thought about doing a chapter on Mothman because, you know, Mothman sightings in Point Pleasant, West Virginia in the 60s, there was a lot of Men in Black activity going on at the same time. You know, these MIB would turn up and interview Mothman witnesses asking what they saw, you know, and because there is at least some sort of connection between some MIB reports and government. I tried, you know, to find anything that might corroborate this and, you know, if there was a Mothman file somewhere. Now, there might be, but I couldn't find it. So, you know, I didn't want to just go over old ground and just, you know, pull a bunch of words from John Keel's Mothman Prophecies because I wanted to add something new if there was. But it wouldn't surprise me if there isn't a Mothman file somewhere when we know that there are Bigfoot files, you know, Flatwoods files, Loch Ness files, you name it files, you know. I think probably there is a Mothman file or file somewhere. The problem is, you know, with the Freedom of Information Act, you can only get files declassified when you actually can identify to a fair degree what it is you want to be classifying.
Kind of like a catch-22.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's what it is.
Yeah, that's funny. Did you come across any documents? I mean, you mentioned there was some redaction in Acoustic Kitty, but was there anything you found that seemed like it could have been a better story, but it was just too heavily redacted or blacked out?
I think one or two of the ones that would fall into that category were the ones that sort of dealt more with real animals used under unusual circumstances. Like there was this project in the Second World War called Project Pigeon, which I managed to get a few files on, but not much. And actually, some of them are still classified. He talks about how the military was planning to use pigeons to remotely sort of pilot rockets and bombs, where they were being like a remotely piloted aircraft, and the pigeon was supposed to be trained to press this button, which would, you know, send this little remotely piloted aircraft with these bombs attached in a particular direction. But the pigeons had like an attention deficit disorder where they just keep pecking the screen and the, you know, these little planes would just slam into the ground or whatever. And what's, you know, it's kind of weird though that some of those files are still withheld. You know, it's like, what on earth could prompt the withholding of a file from 70 years ago on remotely controlled pigeon aircraft, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's sort of bizarre that the files would be withheld at all, you know?
Yeah, it is. Nick, that pretty much brings us to about that time to go. You know, you've always been a great guest. I think I've read about 5 of your books now, which is, that's a lot for me. I mean, I haven't even read that many Harry Potter books. But I'm a big fan of the way you write. You know, there's no filler in your books. It's just story after story. And that's the part that I really love. You know, I still think about... Oh, yeah, of course, man. Thank you. And I still even think about getting a few friends together and taking a trip out to Death Valley or the Grand Canyon looking for some great discovery, because I love that World's Weirdest Places book.
Well, I mean, Death Valley, you know, you got those sailing stones, you know, that go across the landscape, and there's the stories of, you know, sort of supposed like Indiana Jones type, you know, buried temples and things under the ground, you know, going back to Atlantean times and all sorts of weird stuff. So that's all in Death Valley.
Exactly. That book really restored my faith that there might be some discoveries left to make. You know, I've always kind of feel like we're under such surveillance. There's people everywhere. We're all so crowded that there probably can't be any mysteries, but maybe just, 20 feet below us, there might be something crazy.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, before we go, man, is there anything you'd like to tell the people about? Maybe your next topic or maybe your website or something?
Yeah, people can reach me at nickredfern14, F-O-R-T-E-A-N, nickredfern14.blogspot.com or Facebook, just type in Nick Redfern. And at my blog on the right-hand side, I have a list of upcoming lectures and conferences and different places I'll be speaking at and whatever. So.
Yeah, we had Scotty Roberts on not long ago. I mean, you're going to be at the Paradigm Symposium this year, right?
Yeah, I spoke at last year's, and it was a really good event, so I'm looking forward to this one again, and that'll be in Minneapolis in October.
Excellent, man. Well, hopefully some people can make it out to that. You know, it's always an honor and a pleasure, and you know, keep doing what you do, and may the Freedom of Information Act always be your guide.
All right, well, thanks a lot, Greg.
Thank you. There we go, people. Nick Redfern, always a pleasure to talk to that guy. Thanks for all the love and support for THC out there. It's always very motivating. Please share the show as much as you can. Spread it like the plague, people. Review THC on iTunes if you think about it, and I'll keep bringing you interviews with my favorite people. Next week is John Rappaport, so be ready. Peace.